Welcome to True Fraud. I'm your host, Pablo Torres. Today, we're talking to Tim Graham. He's our security analyst here at Reach. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're here because I think I would like to talk with you and I would like for you to talk more about the misconceptions on cybersecurity, how they cross with the field with fraud, the anti-money laundering. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the trends that you're seeing in the market, maybe some predictions, since you're a wizard. And can you define cybersecurity?
I'm sure most people, they've seen the movies, the TV shows where they see the, you know, the person in the hoodie and they're behind the computer and they're, you know, just typing away and the screen's moving all over everywhere. And that's Hollywood. That's definitely Hollywood. Cybersecurity is just basic. It's not as complicated as people think it is.
You mean there's no Will Smith with 20 screens looking at the code come down and
unfortunately, no. It's a lot less glamorous than that. It's a lot of basically just making sure that things that are confidential stay confidential, things that are meant to have a steady state and their integrity intact have that stay intact, and that things are available when people need them. And that's the basics of cybersecurity. And people call that the CIA triad. And that's confidentiality, integrity, and availability. That's basically it. And that's a gross oversimplification, but that's basically just what it boils down to.
What are some of the challenges or maybe some of the things that you deal with on a daily basis? Or let's say maybe somebody with your role, mm-hmm. what are some of those things that they would deal with on a daily basis?
Within the last, I'd say probably 10 years, there's been a big push to have everything in the cloud, everything software as a service, you know, accessible from pretty much anywhere, where traditionally IT and security and that sort of thing would be in-house. Everything's in-house. Your data center's at your head office. You have maybe have a disaster recovery data center offsite, but everything is under control of the company. But now with the push to cloud and all these different services, a lot of what we handle is basically just attack surface management. And that's our main concern for this year. Yeah, it's keeping track of where everything is, who has access to it, who shouldn't have access to it.
Would you say that some of the challenges that corporations and companies just in general deal with on a daily basis, would those threats be mostly external or how much of that could be internal as well? And I guess that's a kind of very open question, but
it is. And it's a good question. A lot of companies will have in a risk assessment, they will tend to weight things differently. So external threats are usually higher up and internal threats, so rogue staff, that sort of thing. It's not as common, but it does happen. So they tend to risk them a little bit lower mm-hmm. because when somebody's internal to your organization, you have more information. And the problem with external threats to your organization, you don't know what they know. And it's gotten to the point where a lot of companies will just assume that an external threat actor knows more about their company than they do, which is oftentimes quite true and somewhat terrifying.
Have you ever heard of any cases where that threat came in from an internal source? And you know, what can you tell us about that? What are the bigger challenges for a company when that is the situation?
With internal threats, I would say most of the time it's staff that have become upset. Actually, I just saw last night that Verizon and T-Mobile staff were getting text messages from SIM swappers offering $300 cash if they would do a SIM swap.
Wow.
On T-Mobile and Verizon staff personal phone numbers. It's with the way security is going, the defenders have been getting a lot better in the last 5 years. And that is good for the defenders, because then the tooling's better. People are able to detect things faster, and then insider threats, to your point, they're detected more quickly. Mm-hmm. Where before, if someone in our organization were to be contacted from someone outside, even just the culture has gotten better, to where people will now say, "Hey, somebody's contacted me from wherever," or somebody texted me on my phone and said, "Hey, I'll give you cash to do this." Where before, people wouldn't even know who to talk to, or if that was even a thing. Where now people will say, "Oh, hey, I saw this weird thing. What do I do? Who do I talk to?" Mm-hmm. Where before, it was more, people were embarrassed, I guess you could say, and they didn't want to talk to anybody about it. They would just, keep quiet about it. And I think the culture is also key to just preventing the insider threat sort of thing.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that, because, when you think about it, that's sort of outside of the realm of cybersecurity, right? The culture of a company. But in the end, it makes the difference.
It does. It does. It's a huge difference.
I find it so interesting because, so number one, I think that whenever people think about cybersecurity, there's already, within a company, it's already put in a very different level than mm-hmm. other things that take priority, right? Like, we need to generate revenue, we need to generate sales, we need to blah blah blah, but then some of the focus on some of the important items gets deprioritized, I guess. But then it also talks about the connectivity between the different departments in the company, right? Mm-hmm. When you talk about the culture and how that can make a difference when you're dealing with a disgruntled employee that could be the lead for a leak of data, that's something that probably a lot of people within a company wouldn't even think about. Mm-hmm. Because everyone thinks, we all work together in a team. You never suspect that somebody that was just upset because they didn't get approved for vacation time or something like that, they're going to be the ones that are going to be the point of the source, I guess, of the issue. But I find it super interesting, because in the end, it kind of translates to different levels within what a company can do, or the activity of the commercial activity of a merchant. If you have somebody from the fraud team, for example, from my perspective, somebody that's upset and somebody that's not happy with what we're offering or the way that we're doing the work and the way that we're communicating as a team, then that person can just say, "You know what? I screw this." And just let a bunch of stuff through, or change controls, or I don't know. There's so many ways that you can go about it. But I think mentioning this, it just goes beyond that cybersecurity. It goes beyond that fraud department. It goes beyond the sales team. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that you mentioned that, and I'm really happy that you brought it up.
The PCI Council and the organization that set out SOC 2, they've started to realize this, and they've started to put controls in and requirements and say, you need to start monitoring for these things, which is, it's awesome. It's great to see that sort of thing happen, and to realize that the defenders are getting information through to regulatory organizations and saying, hey, this is what we're seeing, and we need to start accounting for these sorts of things. And this is a good control to have. And they're actually listening and changing things, like with PCI DSS, the 4.0 standard that just came into effect this year. The controls definitely speak to a defense in depth sort of program, where before it was just real basic stuff, and not necessarily real basic, but, you know, make sure you are using strong passwords, make sure you're using multi-factor where you permit access to a card data environment. And now they're really ramping it up, which is, it's great to see. I love it. It's so good. It's so good.
I mean, if you think about it, two-factor authentication is kind of, I think for a lot of people, it's sort of new news.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know. But when you put it in perspective, this whole security thing has also just become a lot more popular. And I wanted to ask you, do you think, and from what you've been exposed to, do you think that a lot of this focus is mostly in the North American and European markets, or is it something that we're seeing that's more prevalent across the world?
It's definitely global. It's definitely global. That's a lot to do with the push to cloud. A lot of, and like even just looking at Amazon and their AWS service, they have regions in pretty much every corner of the globe, and it's not going away. And a lot of organizations, a lot of companies, a lot of regulatory organizations, they've started to realize that, you know, the internet is not a fad anymore. It's here to stay, and e-commerce is growing every day.
Would you say that, you know, in previous conversations, I've mentioned that, at least on the fraud end, you don't even have to go into the dark web anymore. A lot of this stuff is just available everywhere.
Yep. Absolutely.
Is that the same case with you and what you do?
Yeah, it's gotten to the point where you can, I'm not going to tell people how to do malicious things, but it's getting to the point where a lot of information is just available on ClearWeb. You go into a Discord server, you go onto Telegram forum, or just any forum really, and it's all there. You don't need to go to the dark web. A lot of defenders are catching on to that, and it actually makes our lives a little bit easier, because then we can just have things scrape those services for any information that's related to our company or their company or whoever, and start compiling that information into certain databases, and then start, you know, using graph databases and start putting all of that together and having it make sense. And as far as threat analytics, it's great. Like, now you don't have to potentially have a burner computer to go onto the dark web with and start, you know, going to sketchy sites. It's good.
Hearing you talk about all of this, I'm wondering if, and I'll put it in perspective, in the fraud world, it almost seems like everyone can do it. You don't need a level of expertise. You can just start very basic, and that might even get you through, and it might be successful for some people. There's, of course, you know, if you want to get fancy and you want to learn more, then of course that your effectivity or efficient profile just goes way up. Right?
Absolutely.
Would you say that it's similar in the cybersecurity world?
Yeah, I would say, again, in the last 5-10 years, a lot of people have started to just put information online and say, oh, you want to learn how to do carding? Go to this YouTube page, and it's all there, and it's terrifying, and but it's good, because then with that information readily available, that makes the defenders and the anti-fraud teams, you know, they have to do better. So it's a bit of a cat and mouse game, and that's in the fraud world, in the cybersecurity world, they are definitely linked.
With this new artificial intelligence era and the way that things are moving, you knew that I was going to ask you this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How do you see this? It's still pretty early on, and I'm sure that a lot of it you can sort of identify easily right now, but where are things going with this? How are you seeing this right now?
It's made phishing a lot harder to detect. It's yes and no. When ChatGPT first came along, and these threat actors who were running phishing campaigns, if English wasn't their first language or that sort of thing, and they were trying to communicate with someone who did speak English as a first language, you could tell, and the messages were always very terse, like, "Hey, I'm pretending to be the CEO. Please send me your phone number." Where now with ChatGPT 3 and 4 coming out, the messages are very, very professional. They sound legitimate, and they're getting harder and harder to detect. And eventually, with ChatGPT 5 on the horizon, it's not going to get easier, and it's going to be harder to detect.
Well, what are some tips that, you know, for the regular John Doe, you know, working at an office, what are some of the tips that you could, or maybe can you educate us a little bit on how we could identify this on our daily life?
Hallmark of a phishing campaign is the urgency. It's like, you need to reply. You need to reply now. I need to reply right away. Anytime you see something like that, especially through email, email is a very passive service. And, you know, you send an email, you expect a response back in a day. If it's not a day, it's, you know, it's not good. But to see an email come in and have it be like, you need to respond right now, right away, that's your first red flag. And it's the best one. Anytime you see any sort of like false sense of immediacy and urgency, that's no.
I don't know how much of it you can reveal to us, but you know, give us some of the juicy stuff. Where are most of these attacks, or what's geographically, what's the higher risk source of most of these attacks?
It's probably very similar to the like credit card fraud world. Russia, India, the Maldives, if you can believe it or not, that's a big source for just phishing email. It's interesting. Mostly Russian IPs, and that's pretty standard. And for pretty much any organization, you're going to see that, just because lack of laws, lack of regulations.
Yeah, I mean, I remember early on my years when I started doing anti-fraud and anti-money laundering. I remember any time that we saw a domain, Yandex, that was a questionable source for that activity. No, that's very interesting to know. How much of it do you see that comes from within North America?
Sure, you run into this in the fraud world as well. Attribution's hard. It's any sort of threat actor, they will do what they can to obfuscate where they're coming from, where their traffic's originating from. So with services like VPN services, and you don't even really need VPN services anymore. You could just buy a virtual machine on Amazon AWS or DigitalOcean and pretend, you know, or just use that as the point where you're launching your attacks from, to know where the other traffic is coming from that's controlling that machine. Without a warrant, you won't see any of that. So
yeah, that's very interesting that you mentioned that, because you know, in the last few years, I've definitely seen more of that, where the source of the attacks that we have identified, sometimes they come from AWS servers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you would think that a corporation that big would have a better compliance, regulatory underwriting process that would identify all of this stuff. But like you said, these actors' jobs are to make everything look as legitimate as possible, right? So
100%.
Getting a server from a service like that wouldn't be too hard.
Nope.
And I think it's a good reminder for, you know, not only people that are in the e-commerce world, but just overall in any sort of industry, it's important to understand that this is their job. And they're always the number one thing, the priority is, how do I make this look as legitimate as possible so that I can get through?
And that is the other side of the coin, where stolen credit cards, stolen credentials, stolen identities help them do that. And if they can take that information and pretend to be somebody else, and they're spending $5 a month on a virtual machine, if people aren't really watching their credit card statements, they won't know. They won't notice, like, oh, it's $5 a month and it says Amazon. That's fine.
$5. Yeah.
Until it's not. And then Amazon's knocking on or disclosing your information to police or RCMP or whoever, and saying, hey, this guy over here. And then they show up at your door and you're like,
what?
What are you talking about? So yeah, it's important to keep track, like, just as on a personal basis, to just even look at your statements and make sure there's nothing strange, like anything out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. It's a huge indicator, and you'd need to contact your credit card provider right away and say, hey, this looks fraudulent.
Yeah. And I think for anyone that's listening or watching this, I think if you're not aware of how to do this, when you log into your online banking, there is an option to file an inquiry for payments. Normally, if not, you can always just call your bank. And basically, this inquiry is called a request for information, also known in the industry as an RFI. Basically, what you're asking for is just a little bit more details on where this transaction is coming from, what's the name of the merchant, because I think there's this, you know, the importance of sending the right descriptor or sending the right legend on the payment that will appear on your bank statement gets undermined, I think, mm-hmm. sometimes. And a lot of merchants don't follow up, businesses in general, they don't follow up with making sure that the name that the buyers are going to see in their bank statement matches with who they are. And it's so interesting, because then, you know, going back to kind of like the interconnectivity of all departments, it sort of matches with marketing, right? Because it's mm-hmm. also part of your brand, even though it's a technical deal. And it might not be as hard for some companies to update that, but if in the bank statement, for example, you're gonna see that it says Adyen, or, you know, checkout Stripe, or you know, you name it, there's so many different payment processors in the industry, but if you don't make sure that the name of your company shows up there, then you're going to start getting a lot of these requests for information, you know?
And, absolutely.
And, yeah. And as a cardholder, it is so important that you, I guess, get your money's back worth, right? When you're dealing with a bank and sending this type of inquiries, it doesn't cost you any money. It doesn't cost the merchant or the company any money to receive those. I mean, there's a cost associated with having somebody looking at that request and getting and sending the invoicing, for example, or proof of whatever it is that the payment facilitator is asking for, it's important to keep track of that. And it's kind of like that, the saying of keep everyone on their toes, you know, like keep your bank on their toes. It's important that they know that if you're going to be asking for that information, well, then on their end, they should be asking for that information. And they should be asking the people that they're processing payments for, or, you know, from an issuing bank perspective, if you're authorizing that purchase, then make sure that you're getting the right data from that end. And that's, I think that's super
absolutely
important.
100%.
Can you give us some predictions on the market? What is it that you're seeing that's coming up?
Ransomware, as always, it's not going away. It is here to stay. I saw earlier this week, I don't remember which country, but they had put in were attempting to put in legislation that limited ransomware payments as a way to combat ransomware, because it's so prolific. If you look at any sort of ransomware feeds, and it's constant, it's all day. It's another company probably every hour or two. And it's just, for most companies, it's a matter of time. Aside from ransomware, I would say business email compromise is a big one. That'll be, if it's not $1 trillion a year problem, it will be soon. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies are having to deal with that sort of thing, and a business email compromise it's hard to detect. It's extremely hard to detect, unfortunately. And the other one, unfortunately, is pig butchering scams, where it's basically just a romance scam, but instead of for a week or a month, it's many months, and people get strung along for months and months, and they hand over tens of thousands of dollars of their own personal money. Mm-hmm. And they, after 6 months or so, then they say, well, how do I get my money back or anything like that? And
they're gone. You can.
That's it.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a switch. It's just bang. All that stuff's gone. You're never going to see that again. And I think the worst one I've heard was almost close to $1 million. Where somebody lost to a pig butchering scam.
Yeah.
So
I've heard of a few cases like that. Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I love talking with you. We could go for hours. I think there's so much information that you can share. Yeah. And I think anyone that's listening, they're probably thinking of so many questions that they want to ask you. If there's anything that you want to share with everyone before we close, go ahead.
Don't click the link.
Yes. That's so important.
And just take your time, and if there's anything urgent where somebody's trying to get you to do something right away, just take 5 minutes and just think about it.
Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.